Welcome to Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Bunganyi. I want to thank you for joining us on the show today. And for those of you who want to catch up on our previous episodes, remember to check out our website at voanews.com. We are also on all social media platforms, so be sure to connect with us on there too. Now, on the first part of today's show, we continue the series exploring the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, a global health crisis that continues to affect all aspects of our daily lives. Now, almost 5 months since the WHO declared COVID-19 as a global pandemic, the organization says that there has been over 16 million COVID-19 cases worldwide, with the death toll at over 600,000 deaths since China reported its first cases to the World Health Organization in December of last year. And the two worst hit countries are the US and Brazil, where infection rates continue to spike in some areas, even as some states, especially here in the US, have seen a downward trend in the numbers of infections. In Africa, South Africa, despite having the most advanced healthcare systems on the continent, the country leads the number of COVID-19 cases, and authorities in that country fear that the numbers are steadily trending upwards. But overall, the continent has so far showed resilience in how it has managed the spread of the deadly virus. That is, even though economies are starting to slowly reopen and people are going back to work under what are strict health guidelines, including requirements to socially distance and wear masks in public. And there's fear that if these guidelines are not followed, as the World Health Organization warns, COVID-19 will continue to accelerate globally. For more on this, let's go to Geneva, where Lisa Schlein reports.
The number of coronavirus cases globally has roughly doubled in the past 6 weeks. More than 16 million cases of the virus have been reported to the World Health Organization, including more than 640,000 deaths. The Americas is the most seriously affected region, with the United States topping the number of infections at more than 4 million cases and over 143,000 deaths. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says many lessons have been learned since the pandemic was declared a public health emergency of international concern on January 30th. The most important, he says, is that those countries that have applied basic health measures are containing the virus. He says finding, isolating, testing, and tracing contacts, as well as social distancing and wearing masks, can suppress transmission and save lives.
Where these measures are followed, cases go down. Where they are not, cases go up. Countries and communities that have followed this advice carefully and consistently have done well.
Tedros says countries such as Cambodia, New Zealand, Rwanda, and Thailand have succeeded in preventing large-scale outbreaks by following this advice. He says other countries, including Canada, China, and Germany, have brought large outbreaks under control by applying these basic measures. Executive Director of WHO Health Emergencies Mike Ryan says countries that have implemented control measures have suppressed the virus, but when those measures are lifted, the virus returns.
Well, it's clear that pressure on the virus successfully pushes the numbers down, release pressure on the virus, and the numbers can creep back up. Every single country where pressure has been lifted on the virus, where virus is still at community level, there's been a jump back in cases.
WHO officials agree that continuing transmission of COVID-19 and its resurgence in countries where it had been controlled is worrying. However, they say countries can turn the pandemic around by maintaining pressure on the virus. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And from Geneva, we go to Nigeria. In Lagos, the country's commercial capital, one of the busiest cities in the world. As this city reopens after the lockdown, young people are going back to work, some with new ideas. And as Samuel Okocha reports, the coronavirus pandemic is inspiring entrepreneurship among citizens with many having been forced to develop alternative sources of income. Samuel also reports that small businesses in that city are also doubling down on social media to reach and grow new customers. Let's take a listen.
When Nigeria registered its first case of COVID-19 in March, many Nigerians never knew it would be a pandemic that would have far-reaching effect on the livelihoods of citizens.
Because a lot of people are home, so I had to look for something at least to keep me busy and to bring money home.
Toyin Black is a single mom and works as an independent TV producer in Lagos. She was covering events for her TV show when the pandemic started. As her income from her TV production work dried up due to the impact from COVID-19, she thought of an idea, and that's selling beddings to friends.
I know that they can afford to change their beddings at this time, and they are willing to support. At least they know that you're striving to survive, so at least there's an exchange of something for something.
Toyin says while sharing her TV work online, social media gave her the platform to build connections that later became friends and now her customers.
There are people that I met on social media who, one way or the other, have built trust in my brand. And knowing that the pandemic is making her to do this and we need to support her. So I'll call those people my friend and family.
The story of Toyin highlights how the internet has been a saving grace for people looking to build and grow their small businesses to survive the economic fallout of the coronavirus pandemic in Nigeria.
It is difficult now if you're not on the internet. It seems you are lost. So yes, many entrepreneurs, many SMEs are beginning to embrace the new way, which is the internet way.
Uche Agbo runs Okike Media, a Lagos-based video production and consultancy firm catering to SMEs. It says the COVID-19 pandemic is inspiring new ideas among small business owners looking to build and grow their businesses online.
Immediately they opened up the society and said we can go out. It's not like we have defeated COVID-19 in Nigeria. It simply means the economy is also important. People are hungry. So it is now left between you and your immune system. So I worked with the lady that sells the supplement, and prior to COVID-19, she hardly makes sales. So the woman, should I say, exploited that situation, and her sales begin to soar. Because when she put out the ad, when she put out the video, more and more people discovered her, and she started getting more orders and all of that.
With over 100 million Nigerians connected to the internet, social media platforms provide opportunities for small businesses to emerge and thrive. But many potential small businesses would have to face hurdles such as poor internet speed and expensive data packages. And for those like Toyin Black who can afford to run a duvet business online, social media is not always the answer.
I had a customer. And then I was so excited about the fact that he was ordering almost like 6 duvets and I was to deliver. And then after I told him everything, he was like, no, you have to bring it before I can pay. So I felt a little down, like, oh, okay. So it means that they can still be people, even if they know your personality, they can't trust you because it is social media.
Samuel Okocha, VOA News, Lagos, Nigeria.
Welcome back. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vonganyi. Now, it is true that these past few months have been very tough on everyone and that there is very little to celebrate. But even in tough times, there are moments that deserve recognition and some celebration. And for us, right here on Upfront, that moment was this month when we celebrated the 86th birthday of legendary author, activist Wole Soyinka. Now, a little over a decade ago, we hosted the Nobel laureate on this show, and he spoke on a range of topics, including his philosophy on life, religion, politics, and football. Here is a snippet of our conversation in 2010.
Nigeria is one of those countries that are admirably has been able to retain aspects of its culture and traditions, unlike in many other countries in Africa. Let me ask you what you feel about the type of social change that is occurring in Nigeria and how you would characterize it.
Well, that's a very large question. On the cultural level, in terms of tradition, I mean, you have changes in the evolution going on all the time. If you want to group economic changes, also as part of social changes, which in a sense it is, then I would say that there is deterioration in the sense that the gap between the quote-unquote haves and have-nots, that gap seems to be widening all the time.
Do you see the type of reception to change, to social change among the older generation and the younger generation? There has been a criticism that there's a full embrace with people that I would say are my generation, unlike people from, you know, an older generation of Africans. There has been a kind of a resistance to change.
To speak of Nigeria, I would say that's a very large sweeping statement. I know a lot of people of the older generation who, in fact, recognize and, in fact, feel rather rejuvenated by the social changes, the kind of experimental style, lifestyle, and they're taken, embarked upon by their children, the younger generation. One example which springs immediately to mind is that of Justice Okputa, the father of Charlie Boy, who you might say is one of these sort of punk cultural advocates, very bizarre lifestyle, very talented young individual, but goes his own way, and you could say that he's a sort of social maverick, and you find that he's encouraged in his ways, actively, actually promoted by his retired father of a judge. And, of course, I give that example to show you the other side of the picture. Naturally, there are those of the older generation, my generation, for instance, who view with horror the kind of adoption of new lifestyles by the younger generation. I think that applies to most societies.
That was Nobel laureate Wole Soyinka in our earlier conversation in 2010. As we celebrate Mr. Soyinka's 86th birthday, I reached my friend and acclaimed author, Oken Dibe. He's the author of such books as Arrows of Rain, Foreign Gods, Inc., and his 2016 memoir, Never Look an American in the Eye. Mr. Ndibe's latest book, The Man Lives, a conversation with Wole Soyinka on life, literature, and politics, was born out of hours of conversation with the legendary author. Mr. Ndibe joins me via Skype from his home in Connecticut.
Hello, Mr. Oken Dibe. Hello, Jackson. See you, my brother. It's a delight to see you again. So the reason why I wanted to chat with you today was we share a common admiration for the great Wole Soyinka, a living legend, I believe. And this month, he turned 86 years of age, still a very strong man, very sharp.
He is.
The reason why I brought him up is that I was listening back when I saw his birthday being announced. I remember that I had a conversation with him about 11 years ago when I think he had just turned about 75.
Mm-hmm.
I reached out to him and we spoke at length about different things, and you know, he was very open. So when I heard that it was his birthday, I went back, dug up some in my archives, that conversation, listened to it. And I was like, you know, the person who would contextualize this figure for me would be you, and contextualize it for everybody, kind of get people who have not been blessed by the works of Wole Soyinka. I knew that you would be the perfect person. And then I see that you actually did have a chat with him a
yes.
while ago that has been published. It's been published.
Yes,
in this couple of days. So what did you guys speak about?
Well, we spoke about everything.
Soyinka was very generous with his time. In fact, the original idea was that I would spend several days with him and speak with him for 2 or 3 hours every day for about 4 days. In the end, as you know, Soyinka is an extremely restless, peripatetic being. I joke with him that his address is in the air because at any given moment, during COVID times now, but usually Soyinka is, in an airplane traveling to one part of the world or another. And so it was difficult, extremely difficult for us to find 4 days when I could hold him captive, as it were. So what we did was I interviewed him at his home for about 2.5 hours. And he saw that I was disappointed that I hadn't asked anywhere near the number of questions that I had intended, that I had in my head, And these are questions that cover his life, that cover his politics, that cover his art. And so he invited me. He was invited to a university in Nigeria, the University of Nigeria, actually, for a Lifetime Achievement Award. And then from there, he was going to Makurdi, the capital of Benue State, where there was some political crisis, to speak there. And so he invited me to come out on the trip with him. And so in the car, we were able to, as we rode from the airport to one destination or another, I was able to squeeze in another 2.5 hours of questions. And so the book, the first part of the book is a long essay where I describe sort of my relationship with Soyinka, which began as a high school student.
Wait, I think we need to let our viewers know that there was a book that was born out of that conversation, because I was talking about publishing it as in TV and audio, but you actually do have a book.
I did a book. And the book is called The Man Lives, A Conversation with Wole Soyinka on Life, Literature, and Politics. And, of course, those who are conversant with his work would understand that the title, The Man Lives, is a play on his prison memoir, The Man Died, which was one of his first works that I encountered as a young man, a work that has continued to speak to me, has helped my ethical formation, and sort of instilled a sense of courage in me.
And he was put in jail, I think that was in the 60s, during civil war in Nigeria, that he had spoken up against.
Yes.
And I guess the government or whoever it is who was in power at the time, I guess felt that he was some sort of threat, and they threw him in jail.
Yes. So what happened was, in the buildup of to the Nigerian War, which is sometimes called the Biafran War, it took place from 1967 to January of 1970, a 30-month period, and in which 2 to 3 million Nigerians, mostly on the part of Biafra, a section of Nigeria that wanted to succeed. So 2 to 3 million people died in that war. So as the drums of war were beaten, Wole Soyinka began to organize both domestically as well as internationally a campaign to see if he could stop the country's march to war. But he also felt that the Igbo people or the southeastern part of the country, which was predominantly Igbo, that sought to succeed. He felt that they had been treated unjustly. He felt that there was a genocide against the people. And he also wanted the nation to challenge the nation to address that genocide. For his efforts, the Nigerian federal government arrested him, threw him in jail for about 24 months. And most of that time in solitary confinement. And so out of that harrowing experience, he wrote, he's written several books,
but he wrote a prison memoir called The Man Died. And in that book, there is this very, for me, resonant line where he says that the man dies in all who keeps silent in the face of tyranny. So when I first read that book in as a secondary school student in Nigeria, it spoke to me powerfully. It reminded me of the nemesis of silence. And it reminded me, it was a call to courage and a call to the ethical imperative of speech, especially in situations when there is that temptation to become silent. Because when we have that...
When there is a threat for repercussions...
Precisely.
...about being vocal about, on an issue...
Precisely.
...that's when the moment calls for you to actually speak.
Precisely. And I tell people, you know, it's important that you mention this. Some years ago, I saw a car with one of these... I'm not sort of...
The stickers?
Yeah. And it says, speak, even if your voice shakes. When I saw it, it sort of arrested me. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, I said, not only when your voice shakes must you speak, but especially then.
Absolutely.
Because when your voice shakes, it means that what you have to say has consequences,
right.
Consequential.
Absolutely.
That's when we have the duty, above all, to speak. And so Soyinka exemplified this as a young man in his 30s, facing the machinery of state terror in order to announce, which is, again, another line is in this book, in this prison memoir. Soyinka says that justice is the first condition of humanity. You know, justice is the first condition of humanity. Mm. So
that speaks to this moment that we're in right now.
Absolutely.
In America, in the world.
Yes, it does. It does indeed. It does.
Very prophetic.
So he's been, I mean, as you know, I became a columnist, Nigerian Affairs for several Nigerian newspapers, a weekly column for about 18 years. And my columns ultimately earned me the attention, the unwelcome attention of the Nigerian government, which in 2011 put my name on a list of enemies of the Nigerian state and began to arrest me frequently on my arrivals at the airport, into Nigeria or on my way out of Nigeria.
Mm. At the time you were living in the US, so we should
remind
our viewers and listeners that you came in the late 80s.
You came because
the late great Chinua Achebe invited you to be an editor of a magazine.
Yes, absolutely. So I've lived in America since December of 1988. And then I started writing a column in Nigeria, 1999, when Nigeria returned after years of military rule to a quasi-elected government. And I was wounded, I felt affronted by the monumental corruption and the putting aside, really, of the business of the people. By politicians who then proceeded to steal the resources that should go into improving the lives of people. And so I began to call them out in very direct, unsparing language for who they were. I called them reprobates. I called them, you know, thieves, which is what they are.
And they were not happy about that.
Oh, no, they were not happy. And their first impulse was to see if I could be bought over because, you know, they command a lot of resources. So, you know, so initially messages were sent to find out if I wanted some political position, if I wanted, would you settle for some money? But I said, listen.
To try and transfer you.
Yeah, precisely. So I told them that there wasn't enough money to buy me. And so they went to intimidation. So several times I was arrested coming into the country, leaving usually for a few hours. On one occasion, they held me overnight for 10 hours. But usually they would hold me for 1 to 3 hours until somebody in Abuja would give instructions that I could be let go.
Yes, deliberately inconvenience you so that you don't come back again or you think twice before you write the next column.
Or they wanted to, precisely, to silence you. In fact, on one occasion, I flew into the country with Wole Soyinka. You know, we met in Atlanta. We were on the same flight. The flight left late. So, you know, we spent a long time at the airport talking. And then he said to me, I hope they no longer harass you when you come. And I said, oh, indeed, they did. So then we arrived at the airport. And when he was leaving, he saw that they were holding me and he wanted to stay with me. I said, hell no. I said, please.
It's like cross to bear. Let me carry my own cross.
To him, you were in jail for 20 plus months, as a younger person.
Yeah.
You bore it. I can take the inconvenience of being held for a few hours, So I said to him,
that was
actually the occasion when they held me overnight in the end.
Yeah. I guess as as an older brother, he felt, that he needed to be there for you.
And he is very, very generous in that way.
Let me ask you this. I going back to Wole Soyinka, I remember when I spoke to him, it was during the World Cup, African World Cup. I did ask him about, what does he think about, soccer in general? He wasn't really into soccer that much.
I knew he wouldn't be.
I was very surprised for an African man knowing that soccer is very popular on the continent.
Yes.
Well, it was. I mean, he understood the moment for what it was. The first time the World Cup was being played on the continent of Africa.
Yes.
But not a big fan of soccer, and I guess that's the one thing that we did share. You know, for my viewers who did not know, I'm not really big into soccer like that.
Okay, not either. I have good reason not to be. I nearly died in Lagos at a stadium, and so I began.
You had gone to
the stadium in Lagos National Stadium to watch an international game between Nigeria and I think Egypt. I arrived and the stadium was already full. And so there were people who had gone in, pressed themselves in, saw that there were no seats and they were trying to come out. But hundreds of people, perhaps thousands, were still, trying to get in. And so very soon I was caught in the middle of this human maelstrom and being crushed from all sides, from the back, from the side, and so on.
In the middle.
And after that day, I said, I could have been dead. So I lost interest in soccer, what we call football.
That is that's one of the most bizarre stories I've heard about soccer.
I haven't actually written, but, I haven't thought about it. But so I came to this country and then took to what they call American football, basketball, baseball. So, I've lived in this country long enough. So when I see Nigerians who are all so excited about Chelsea and Man U and Everton, I actually don't know one single player.
And with that, we come to the end of our show today. I want to thank my guest, acclaimed novelist Okendibe. You can check out his work at www.okendibe.com. Now, I want to remind our listeners that we still have two more parts of our conversation in the coming weeks with Mr. Ndibe on the life and philosophy of Wole Soyinka. Also want to remind you that for video snippets of our conversation with Okendibe, check out our social media platforms. We are on Facebook, on Instagram, and on Twitter. Just type in Upfront Africa Show. So let's catch up next time right here on Upfront. But until then, stay safe, my friends. And as Wole Soyinka says, the man dies in all who keeps silent in the face of tyranny. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Good day, Africa.